Tonight, by the grace of God, I would like to continue what we have been saying on the previous days. This season, and more specifically, the first part of the Triodion, contains these four Sundays, as we said when we outlined the whole period. By the grace of God, we have already passed through the first, known as the Sunday of the Publican and the Pharisee, and also the second, the Sunday of the Prodigal Son, God willing. We shall now come to the third Sunday. This third Sunday has something to say about the other two. On those two Sundays we heard certain teachings, and we were shown the ways we ought to follow. So now we can no longer offer any excuse. The Lord, while fully respecting our freedom, has done everything that had to be done and said everything that had to be said. The coming Sunday will call us to account for how we have lived in response to what He taught us. This applies both to the parable of the publican and the Pharisee, and to the parable of the prodigal son. In both cases, as you saw, He justified people who had indeed sinned, but then repented. One struck his breast and asked God for mercy. The other repented, returned, confessed, and was restored. Then, following especially upon the second parable, that of the prodigal son, which contains the whole spirit of the matter within it, the coming Sunday now arrives to pronounce judgment. Generally speaking, people do not want judgment, and the reason they do not want it is the usual one. A person does not want to be examined because his life is not in order. Someone whose life is in order does not fear examination, no matter when it comes. But because our lives are not in order, indeed, they are almost never in order, we do not want this examination. And yet, whether we want it or not, we shall be judged. As for how we shall be judged, He has already told us. We Orthodox Christians in particular shall be judged very strictly, because we shall be judged by our conscience, by the law, and by the gospel. We lack nothing. We, especially those living today, have not lived in an age when there was no gospel, when Christ had not yet come, or when the law had not yet been given. We live in an age in which we possess all these things, and for that reason we shall be judged more strictly. We have a conscience that urges us toward good and restrains us from evil. We also know the law of the Ten Commandments. You shall not steal. You shall not commit adultery, you shall not engage in sexual immorality, and all the rest. And we have the gospel, with the subtle and exalted commandments of the law of the gospel, so that now we have no excuse at all. It can only mean that we simply do not want to. This is the most serious reality. It is something no one will escape, whether they believe it or not. Those who lived before Christ and those who lived after Christ, all will come to judgment one day. There are two kinds of judgment. One is temporary. One is temporary, and the other is final. The temporary judgment is the judgment a person faces after death. Every person is judged partially after death, but one day each person will also be judged fully. Neither those who have succeeded nor those who have failed have yet received the full measure of what they deserve. Those who have failed know that they have failed and have been condemned to hell, but they do not yet suffer as fully as they will after the universal judgment. Likewise, those who have succeeded already enjoy blessedness, but not as fully as they will after the universal judgment. God having provided something better, so that they should not be made perfect apart from us, says Paul to his fellow Hebrews, as we read in the final verse of the 11th chapter. The universal and final judgment, therefore, will also bring about the final restoration of each and every person. The case of each person remains unsettled from the day of death until the judgment. The files remain open, and changes are made in accordance with the intercession offered to Christ by the church that remains in this world. Neither the saints nor those condemned to hell have a closed file. Some people lived here and became the means by which others were saved. They led them and guided them. Others wrote, labored, and left behind a spiritual or material work. The results of all this continue to be credited to them and added to their files. Other people lived here in indifference and unbelief. They ruined the lives of others, or left behind writings that continue to corrupt people, and so forth. Perhaps they did shameful things, or said things that led people astray, or by the example of their lives formed others into people who remained far from God and were condemned to hell. The poison of that destruction continues to flow into their files. That is why only at the last judgment will we be able to say that a person's influence has finally come to an end. People today read Kazantzakis, to give a simple example, even though he has died. I would call him the blessed departed. But he is not blessed. People today also read Marx and, as we know, other theories and materialistic and atheistic writings that lead them away from God. The consequences of these things are added to the file that still remains open there. Today, for example, people read John Chrysostom. They read Basil the Great. They read the lives of St. Nicholas and St. Spyridon. People are edified, they repent, and they return to God. Where do these results, this fruit, this spiritual benefit go into their record? That is why I tell you that each person's case is not yet closed, and why I call this the particular judgment, not the complete judgment. The last judgment, the complete judgment, will come when the curtain finally falls, when Christ sits upon the throne and judges mankind in righteousness. Then there will be no further opportunity. Blessed, therefore, are those who have left no matters unresolved and no situations behind that might harm them, and send them even deeper than where they are now. And blessed are those who live such a life here, who set a radiant example and left behind a beautiful memory, so that others may imitate them and be guided toward the kingdom of heaven. This momentous event, which is not unrepeatable, is the most serious event there is, for it brings the history of mankind to its final close. It is something that should fill a person with fear and keep his whole being under its solemn constraint. One can understand the seriousness of this matter from all that God has done concerning this event. Someone may ask, what has God done? Almost from the very beginning of the world, He has had this event written about and spoken of. You know the accounts He gives us. One is this passage from the 25th chapter of Matthew, verses 31 through 46. In verse 46, He reveals to us that one day He will come in the fullness of His glory, with myriads of angels. All humanity, from Adam until that day, will stand before Him, and He will separate them as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. To some He will say, come, and to the others, depart. Do you know what this is? It has been written since the foundation of the world. This image of the judgment of the world is displayed especially in Orthodox churches. As we go out through the door, the judgment is depicted above it to remind us, take heed as you go out. This is what awaits you. Do not sin, because this awaits you. God presents it as a scene and has shown it to many people. He showed it to Enoch. Enoch is the seventh generation from Adam. At the age of 365, he was taken up, like the prophet Elijah, and he remains alive to this day. He will return to the scene with the prophet Elijah and play a part in religious events. He saw this very scene that Christ speaks of in Sunday's Gospel. Daniel saw it 750 years before Christ, the same image described by Christ. Christ also showed it to John, who recounts it for us in the Apocalypse. Three people saw this scene that our Lord describes, and the Apostle Matthew preserved it for us in the 25th chapter of his Gospel. Jude also writes about it. You know that there is an epistle of Jude, not Judas Iscariot, just before the Apocalypse in your New Testament. Before the Apocalypse begins, there is the Epistle of Jude, one of the seven Catholic epistles. It consists of a single chapter. In verses 14 and 15 of that chapter, we read this, and Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men also, saying, behold, he is pointing to it. There you have it. The Lord came, and did the Lord come by himself, I ask you? No, with his holy myriads, that is, with tens of thousands of saints, exactly as our Christ said 2,000 years ago. Why did he come? To execute judgment, he came to hold judgment. And whom is he to judge? Against all, he is to judge them all, and to convict all the ungodly among them. Concerning all their works of ungodliness, the seventh from Adam, Enoch, was counted worthy to see that judgment spiritually. In the seventh chapter of his book, verses 9 and 10, the prophet Daniel says, "I beheld, I watched, until thrones were set in place. The court was being prepared, and the Ancient of Days took his seat." The Ancient of Days is Christ, though others interpret this differently. He took his seat because Christ is the one who will judge. All authority has been given to the Lord, including authority to execute judgment. His garment was white as snow. He was clothed entirely in white, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. The hair of his head was like clean wool. His throne was a flame of fire, and its wheels were burning fire. He sat upon a fiery throne, and the little wheels beneath it were also aflame. A river of fire issued forth before him. In front of him, a river of fire was flowing past. If you read the Epistle to the Corinthians, Paul's first letter, you will find it there, where he says, "Watch what you do with your works. Don't let them be of hay. Don't let them be of wood. Let them be of gold. Let them be of silver. Let them be able to stand up to the flames. Let them be able to stand up to the fire, because they will be burned there, and you yourselves will be burned up along with them." Connect that with the apostles' exhortation. 1,000 thousands ministered to him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. This was revealed 750 years before Christ. That was the second person who saw it. The third was John. In two passages of the Apocalypse, he speaks of it, in Revelation 1:7, where he describes the Lord coming, and in the 20th chapter from verse 11 onward, where he gives more details. In chapter 1, verse 7, he says, "Behold, he cometh with the clouds, and every eye shall see him, and they also which pierced him, even those who ran him through right here in the side will see him, and all the tribes of the earth shall mourn because of him. And as the saying goes, the knees of the whole world will give way." Further on in his 20th chapter, he says exactly how he saw the court assembled, and the court itself. "And I saw a great white throne, and him who sat upon it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. New heavens and a new earth we look for, in which righteousness dwells." He also saw the new earth and the new heaven. Again, John speaks of them in the following chapter, chapter 21. "The present earth and heaven will pass away. And I saw the dead, great and small. Everyone will come to the judgment, standing before the throne. And books were opened." I have told you before there are three books that record every event in a person's life: the book of Satan, the book of the conscience, and the book of the angel. Above all, a person's sins are written in three records, and it is difficult for them to be erased unless he repents and confesses them. A person's good deeds, though, are written down only in their conscience, and the angel records them as well. The devil does not write those down. He has no desire for anyone to talk about them. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. All people are creatures of God, but not all are written in the book of life. Only those who have been baptized and have received the author of life. Read the prayers for the naming of a child in the eucologian and see what they say. They ask Christ to grant that the mother may complete her 40 days and that the child may be baptized and enrolled in the book of life. Those who have been baptized are written in the book of life. That is a separate book. And the dead were judged according to what was written in the books, according to their works, according to faith and works. And the sea gave up. Here is a question many people have: the dead which were in it, the sea gave up. What does that mean? The sea gave up. Does the sea keep them safe? But the fish ate them, and what of it? Didn't the fish pass them out again? Aren't the particles of their bodies still there in the water? After all, since the splitting of the atom, science has shown that matter is not lost. It merely changes form. And so the sea gave up the dead who were in it, and death, physical death in Hades, hell, gave up everyone. The sea gave up the dead that were in it. "Everyone, come here, you are going to be judged." And they were judged, each one according to their works. I have set before you three events that were not heard, they were seen. I saw a throne, I beheld, behold, the Lord showed these things to them. Nothing like this has happened with any other events. There are indeed prophecies, but there are no such visible representations, and this is because the judgment is the most serious matter of all concerning which God did not wish to leave man uncatechized or without direction. That is why in serious matters God warns and even threatens him many times in order to help him so that he may not leave him spiritually slack and unrestrained. You saw what he said to the first couple. He told them, "On the day that you eat from the tree, you shall surely die, you will die. It is a terrible thing to die, but it depends on you. I am telling you now, so do not be angry with me afterward. You will be responsible. The same thing happens here. I have told you everything. I have revealed it to you." There was a fine answer he gave, which is found in Matthew chapter 24, verse 27, and in verse 30 there is a certain line of reasoning. The first thought concerns how it will happen. Will a notice be sent out first? Will someone sound a trumpet beforehand and so on? No. It will happen so instantaneously in the twinkling of an eye that you will not even have time to say your own name. Writing about the second coming, Paul says, "In the twinkling of an eye, with a cry of command, and the voice of an archangel." Just as your eye closes automatically when a mosquito or something else comes near it, so swiftly will the judgment take place. No one will have time to move. Some will rise from the dead, while those of us who are alive will immediately be changed, and those who belong to him will go to meet and welcome the Lord in the air. Thus he says, "For as the lightning comes from the east and is seen even in the west, so shall be the second coming of the Son of Man." When he was being judged before Annas and Caiaphas, open chapter 24 there, and you will see they said many things to him. Annas and the others pressed him hard. But in the end, as you know, he did not speak, and many took offense because he remained silent. Yet at one point he said, "Then the sign of the Son of Man, the precious cross, will appear in heaven. Then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming upon the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." It was as though he were saying to them, "You will send the Son of Man down, but he will come to you from above, and woe to you when he comes from above." And that is indeed what happened. The church also speaks of this in the funeral service, because of the seriousness of the event, so that no one may remain uninformed, unaware of what is to come. The church always draws from chapter 5 of John, where there is a beautiful and very instructive verse, "The hour is coming when all who are in the tombs, all of them, both righteous and unrighteous, will hear his voice, that is, the voice of Christ, and will come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment." There is another beautiful passage as well, in Matthew 16, verse 27. "For the Son of Man is to come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he will repay each person according to his deeds." Whether we choose to believe it or not, just as all the other prophecies have been fulfilled, so this one too will be fulfilled. Two more things were said about this. One was spoken here on the Pinnax in Athens. The other was spoken when our Christ was taken up in the ascension. There two angels came and stood beside them, and they said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand there gazing into heaven? This same Jesus, who has been taken up from you into heaven, will come in just this way." That second word, hotos, spelled with an omega, is an adverb. It means in the very same manner. He will come in just this way, in the same manner as you saw him going away from you. And where did this information come from? From the royal court, the great heavenly court. Men in white garments stood beside them, angels. They came to proclaim this to them and, through them, to the whole world. This Jesus has left something still to be fulfilled. We do not understand what we ourselves say in our creed, "And he shall come again to judge the living and the dead." This is what we proclaim when we make the sign of the cross. "He who is without beginning came and became man. He was taken up in the ascension, and he shall come again to judge the living and the dead." Whether we ourselves believe it or not, we say it in the church through the chanter. But when we step out onto the porch of the church, there is Nicholas and there is Paradis. "Who has ever gone there?" you ask me. "Yes, but he said these things, says them now. and will continue to say them what is needed are people willing to receive them. Here Paul said, "The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent." Why, Paul? Because he says he has appointed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man. Who is this man? He is Christ, the Son of God and the Son of the Virgin. He has appointed a day of judgment, the apostle says, having overlooked the times of ignorance. Until now, you worship stones, you placed your gods on Mount Olympus, and you even built an altar to the unknown God. But from now on, everything changes. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. Even among men, ignorance of the law is no excuse. Go to court and say, "I did not know, Your Honor." They will send you inside so that you can learn for how long. You will have no time for anything else but learning. There is no plea of ignorance before God. We will be judged and condemned. Let us not expect God to be lenient, especially today when we have so much light. For there is a failing in us. We have landed on earth. We have landed on the moon, yet we still have not come down to earth. And this is our own error. After all that we have done, we still have not wanted to understand this. In his first epistle to the Thessalonians, the Apostle Paul speaks in the passage we read at the funeral service, chapter 4, verses 15 through 17. I will simply remind you of it. "For this we say to you by the word of the Lord. What I am telling you," he says, "is not my own teaching. We who are alive and remain," this "we" is not meant only of Paul himself. It means you who may be alive later, whenever that may be. He says "we," including himself, because he believed that the second coming could take place at any moment. He included himself to show that we must always be ready. We who are alive and remain until the second coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who have fallen asleep. If we are still alive, we will be changed before those who will come out of the grave. What I am telling you is a mystery of mysteries, the resurrection and the transformation, and you should know above all that the righteous will rise first. When the graves are opened, the righteous will come forth first. And do you know, my beloved, what proportion of the righteous lies buried in the earth? Do you know? 5%, not even 5%. I am not permitted to tell you. I have not been given the command to reveal that detail. This shows you how grave the matter is. From this place I offer only one prayer. May you be counted worthy to be among that small percentage. And this, of course, does not depend on God. It depends on us. In any case, it is not even 5%. Among 1,000 graves, each of which may contain 3, 4, 5, or 10 people, depending on how old the cemetery is, you may see only 50 or 60 people come forth, while the others remain within. Go to the cemeteries and see. A great proportion of the bodies remain unnaturally incorrupt. And this is not only here, but in cities and villages as well. They are buried one above another. Humanity is under demonic influence, bound by sorcery, bound by anger and curses, bound by everything imaginable. It is far from God and far from the church, and when the body remains bound, it is because the soul itself was bound. We will not precede those who have fallen asleep, he says. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And thus we shall always be with the Lord. For this reason, the divine John Chrysostom offers a concise reflection, a beautiful remedy and an exhortation. It is a prayer which I have preserved, and it says the following. Remember that dread and fearful day when all will stand before the judgment seat of Christ to give an account of their deeds. Always keep this scene before your nose. The spiritual mind, whether you want it or not, whether you believe it or not, one day you will come to judgment. Into judgment for all these things he will bring you into judgment. And Solomon the Wise has another beautiful passage in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 addressed to young men and women who, for the most part, trample religious matters underfoot, to put it no more harshly, since propriety does not allow it. There at the outset, speaking through the Holy Spirit, he says, "Yes, follow the desires of your flesh and of this world and go wherever you please, but know that for all these things he will bring you into judgment. One day you will pay for them. Why? Will we not appear before the judgment seat? Will these hens judge us? Will someone else devour us? Believe whatever you like, and believe me, if there were no... If death did not exist, we could debate the matter. But since death does exist, whether we like it or not, we must consider it. And we do so in the light of Him who came from beyond and returned there again. This applies to everyone, especially today, with all the many modern forms in which death now comes upon us. Whole families, whole groups of friends, an airplane crashes and 400 die together, a car crashes, and an entire family is lost. Just the other day, a group of friends plunged over a cliff. 4, 5, 6 people. There are countless such tragedies. A fire breaks out in a club. Fires over here. Over there a boat goes down. Somewhere else there's a crash. People die at 18, at 17, at 10, at 25, at 3. You don't have to grow old first. And I say that because there's a certain mentality out there, a certain theory. Well, they have grown old. They are approaching death. Yes, the elderly approach death, but death also approaches the young. Very well, the elderly are approaching death and must be watchful. But could death not also be approaching the young? Must we not be watchful too? In the face of death, we all stand in the same condition at every moment. At every moment I came up here to speak about these things, but who knows whether I will go back down. And you came here, but who knows whether you will return to your homes. You may have an appointment. People may be waiting for you. You may have children and work to attend to, but whoever said that these things are guaranteed, they can all be left unfinished. And so the divine Chrysostom says, remember that dread and fearful day on which you will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ and give an account for what you have done where? There, everyone's sins will be set before all eyes. Then everything we concealed from our husband, from our wife, even from the priest, everything we hid, wherever we hid it will be uncovered. There, he says, all things will be laid bare. The filth within each one of us will be revealed. Everyone's sins will be set forth, revealed, and shown even to those who knew nothing of them. Look at him, they will say on that day. There is the fountain of fire and the worm that never sleeps. There all things are naked and exposed. There the books of our hearts will be opened, and before all will be read both what was known and what was hidden, what was done by night and what was done by day. This exhortation helps a person, if he is willing to be watchful, to act in time and avoid such a state. Yes, it will happen, it certainly will, but when it will happen, I do not know. His disciples asked him for an answer, for some information, but he did not give it to them. It is not for you to know the times or seasons which the Father has fixed by his own authority. Your task is not to learn when it will happen, when the kingdom will be restored, and so forth. Your task is to be ready. That is the point. A person who is ready is not concerned about when the inspection will take place, when the director will come, or when the judge will arrive. He is not worried. It does not trouble him. Indeed, at times he may even say, let him come as soon as possible. Because I do not know what condition I will be in tomorrow. Human beings are changeable, just as many people who, by human reckoning, seem to be heading straight for hell at full gallop, find themselves in paradise through an act of metanoia, repentance, or through some unexpected event. So too many who believed and whom others believed to be heirs of paradise find themselves in hell. Human beings are changeable. That is exactly why our forebears used to tell us never to call anyone blessed before the end. Before the end, call no one blessed. And Paul said the same thing in his own words, his God-inspired words. The one who thinks he stands, whoever imagines he is standing firm, let him take heed lest he fall. For the cunning destroyer, Satan, the enemy, with 7,500 years of experience behind him, labors against us until the very last moment. Even when the angel comes to take our soul, even then we must remain in fear. Saint Anthony the Great taught us this beautifully. I do not know whether you have heard or read the account. When the angel took the soul of Saint Anthony the Great, Satan stood at a distance, grasped his beard, and cried, "Ah, Anthony! You have escaped me." And do you know what Anthony answered? Experienced as he was in the devil's ways, he said, Not yet. Was he not already safe? He was in the angel's hands, yet even then he feared the devil. He took the devil seriously. He reckoned with Satan. We do not take him seriously. We even tell other people to go to the devil as though we wish to enlarge his kingdom. We say it even to our children and our wives. This, then, is the most serious matter. God has made it known to us in so many ways that he has left us without excuse. On the one hand, he helps us and casts light upon our path so that we may be watchful. On the other, he leaves us without excuse if we deliberately refuse to take heed. As you know, you learned this passage at school. It is a text that is both prophecy and parable. It is a prophecy because it says, "When the Son of Man comes, he will indeed come one day when he comes." And it is a parable because it presents a shepherd separating the sheep from the goats. That is the parable. Within this parable, how does he separate the two groups? To the one group he turns and says, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." Then he turns to the others and says, "Depart from me, you cursed," and so on. And to the others he said, "Go into the fire prepared for the devil and his angels." This is the moment where I have to give an answer to certain people who want a God who is good, but who don't want him to be just. And they often say, "Can the things the priests and the preachers say really be true? Has the Lord and God, who is at least as good as you say, he has made hell for man?" The answer is that he has not made hell for man. For man, he has prepared a kingdom. Come, inherit the kingdom. Is there no hell then? Of course there is. For whom is it prepared? For the devil. Depart into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. This is what God has prepared. So how is it that I do not go to paradise? Paradise? He has done nothing to make us go to paradise. Once, when I was speaking with someone at the Soteria Hospital, he said to me, "I want to go to hell with my tough friends." He was playing with his worry beads as he spoke. "I'm going with my friends," he said. "I wanted to go with the others." "Then go with your friends to hell." God is good. He doesn't keep you apart from him. Wasn't that what you liked? Wasn't he the one you took for your counselor? Wasn't I the one you cursed and blasphemed? Wasn't I the one you didn't give 2 cents for? Go on then. Go with him. There is no third state. There is no middle ground there. There are only the far right and the far left. There is no center there. You did nothing worthy that would bring you this way, so you will of necessity go the other way. There is no other place. But know this, that place was made for Satan. It was not made for you, it was made for him. Yet you did not desire what God offered. You feed on carob pods in this world, afraid of missing even a single pleasure. Go with him, then. This is how God is just. It is not that he made that place for man, but man will necessarily go there if he has not done the works of God and has instead done the works of Satan. What scandalizes and misleads certain people, and what I would like to explain as far as time allows, is the passage that says, "For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was in prison, and you came to me. I was sick, and you visited me," and so forth. They present this as righteousness and say that this alone is enough to bring a person into paradise, and so we speak of good people. Yet, I dare say, we ourselves do not even have this side of it. We cannot claim even the deeds on this list. Who among us has gone to visit someone who is sick? Someone will say, "What do you mean? I do visit the sick." You visit your relatives so that they will not take offense. You do not visit the brethren of the Lord. If none of your relatives is sick, have you ever gone to a clinic, to the hospital for the chronically ill, to Soteria Hospital, or to a psychiatric hospital? Have you ever asked the director there, who has no one coming to visit him? For many people have no visitors at all. When have you ever gone? Never have you gone there to stand beside such a person. Where is your love? We are not right with God even in this respect. Have you ever gone to a prison and asked the warden, "Who here has no visitors?" There are people who have been in prison for 10 or 20 years without receiving a single visitor. Have you gone to see such a man, to speak with him, to ask whether he needs anything from outside, to bring him a book, to learn his name and write it down so that you can pray for him to do something? Perhaps he needs a couple of drachmas so that in his weakness, as we say, he too can buy a packet of cigarettes. Have you done any of that? Not that either. Do you ever go to the prison? Am I supposed to rub shoulders with some crook in there who's done things like that? So that's how it is. And do we ever let anyone into our home? Do we keep a room for strangers for someone who comes in a time of need? Perhaps someone from your village or from some distant place comes here for an operation and needs somewhere to stay for 5 days, so that he will not be fleeced by a hotel and suffer further hardship away from home. Have you provided such a place? You have not made room even for your own mother or father. You cast them out. Will you now make room for a stranger? And yet the man who reads the Quran has a guest room. Did you know that? Yes, the Muslim who reads the Quran keeps a room for the stranger who may come. So where do we stand? Consider just this side of the matter, I tell you. Have we done any of these things, anything we would dare present before God? I will leave the rest aside. We do not possess even this side of it. Let us not deceive ourselves. But that is not how it works. A person is not saved by his works. Yes, Christ requires these things, but from whom does he require them? That is the point. From whom does he require them? He requires them from his relatives, from those whom the Father told to come and inherit. Who inherits? Do the workers inherit? Suppose an unmarried man in America owns a business worth $100 million. He has many people working for him, and so on. Then he dies. Who will receive his wealth? Who will inherit from him? The workers? Or you may read in the newspaper that the heirs of so-and-so are being sought, and suddenly some distant relative from this village will appear, or a cousin from somewhere else, and so on. He will go and obtain the papers proving that he is a relative, then go over there and come back a millionaire. He will inherit the estate. Is that not how it is? Are we relatives of God, that we should have a share in the inheritance? Because what's at stake here is a kingdom, he says. Come, inherit the kingdom of my Father. When a king dies, who is going to inherit from him? Us, ordinary mortals, or the princes, the people of the palace, the children, the princesses. Who is going to inherit? They are the ones who will inherit. Are we then his relatives, so that we have a rightful claim for our Christ? Come and learn this, understand it, is not an employer, my dear friends. We cannot keep accounts with him. I did this. I gave away so many pairs of shoes that did not fit me, and so much food that would otherwise have been thrown away. Now let him pay me. God does not settle accounts like that. God is the giver of life, not an employer. Christ is the giver of life. What is his side called? His life-giving side. What is his cross called? His life-giving cross. What is his tomb called? His tomb, the life-giving tomb. What is the chalice called? The bread of life. What is the holy altar called? The table of the bread of life. The whole matter is about life. It is not simply a question of saying, I do good works. Do good works, Christ requires them. But first you must show me your credentials. Two documents are needed. One proving your kinship with Christ, and one proving your works. Christ does not mean for you merely to say, I believe in you, I go to church. I go to church, I confess, I receive Holy Communion, but do not ask me for a penny. Why should I care what happens to other people? I believe. The devil also believes, yet he is not saved, because he has no good works. His works are the very opposite. Christ desires your faith. But faith working through love, from those who are his relatives, who are Christ's brothers and God's children. He also requires works of love toward those who suffer, those in tribulation, the sick, and those in prison. Let them see it. Let them see our good works, so that the Father in heaven may be glorified. Because otherwise, what happens? Papism has works, in fact, it has works to spare, so many that it even pays off other people's accounts. Protestantism has faith, I believe, just believe and you are saved. Neither the one nor the other will do. They are the two oars, right faith and right action, orthodoxy and orthopraxy. These two together guide a person rightly toward eternity. How then can a person be recognized as a relative of God? Through Jesus. Those who receive Christ are the ones who have the right to say the Our Father. The others should not be saying it. As many as received him, John 1:12. To them he gave authority to become children of God. But people ask, as we have said on other occasions, aren't all human beings children of God? No, they are creatures, fashioned beings, things made by God. The children of God are those who have received Christ, those who have been baptized into Christ, and those who receive the body and blood of Christ in Holy Communion. They are Christ's brothers, and by extension, God's children. They are heirs, if we may put it this way, to God's estate, which is the kingdom. Christ alone is the natural heir. We are co-heirs with Christ. By grace we become Christ's brothers and the Father's children. If Christ is not our brother, God is not our Father. And to become one with Christ, I must be united with him, becoming one body and one blood with him, sharing, that is, in his blood. How is it, as we said, that a person comes to say Holy Communion? Has that ever made you stop and wonder? Divine communion means divine communication. We commune with the other. We are in contact with the other. The church is in communion with the other members of the church. There is communication between them. Holy communion is divine communication. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. Read the 15th chapter of John, the vine and its branches. I am the vine, he says. You are the branches. He who abides in the vine bears much fruit. Whoever does not abide in the vine is cut off and thrown into the furnace. Why the latter? Yes, no, not the latter. Why the vine? Because the vine is depicted above the royal doors, flowing from the mystical supper. Look above the royal doors. There is the mystical supper where we see the body and blood of Christ. The vine begins there. Those who draw nourishment from the vine bear good fruit. It is like a branch that remains on the vine and draws its sap from it. What do those juices produce? They produce leaves and grapes. In the grapes they produce alcohol and sugar. Through what do they flow? Through the vine, through the stock. Christ is the vine stock. Therefore, if a person has no relationship with Christ, if he has cut himself off, because he wants to go on sinning and does not come to Holy Communion, then he is not a brother of Christ, and consequently is not a child of God and has no share in the inheritance. That is why, if you remember, when we returned after the feast days, our watchword was this: if you want to make good use of the time granted to you through God's kindness and long-suffering, take care to make the Holy Chalice fruitful within yourself. My beloved, as long as the Holy Chalice remains covered and untouched, humanity will remain possessed by demons and will go down to hell with everyone aboard. It is the Holy Chalice that creates within us the conditions for entering the kingdom of heaven. It is the blood of Christ. Here, in his veins, man carries the blood of Adam. That Adamic blood leads man to hell. This is why I receive a transfusion, not because I am worthy, but because I am sick. And I receive a transfusion of the blood of Christ. I receive it so that I may become a child of the King, so that I may not remain the old common man, koinos, spelled with omicron iota, but may become the new man, kainos, spelled with alpha iota. I must not remain a man of dust, but become spiritual. I must not remain earthly, but become heavenly. This is why man can commune every day, receiving Christ and being in communion with him, so that his nature may be changed and his blood may be changed. Then, since the blood of God, the blood of the King of all, will be flowing within him, he will be a child of the King and will have a rightful share in this kingdom and this inheritance. That is how matters stand. Then, this person who possesses these credentials, who goes to Holy Confession, has been baptized, receives Holy Communion and so forth, will also take care to perform good works according to his strength. Thus he may appear with his ticket, which is Jesus, and with his luggage, which consists of his good works, and travel freely and securely to the kingdom of heaven. For a person's works do not secure his entrance into it. Entrance is through Jesus Christ. This is what the teaching says. It does not reject good works, but it requires first that a person possess the true faith and be in communion with Christ. To conclude, the coming week is Cheese Fair Week. We stop eating meat next Sunday, and those of us who remain in good health will meet it again on the night of the resurrection. This coming Wednesday and Friday, there is no relaxation of the fast. On the other days, we may eat fish, butter, milk, cheese, eggs, and all foods derived from animals, but no meat. Apocryo means abstaining from meat. There is no such thing as a first and a last meat fair. That comes from Satan and from people's bellies. Listen, if you wish. That is how matters stand. I wish you a blessed carnival season and a good evening.